Hello, you're with Helen with the Talk and Information Center with readings from the New York Times Book Review. Today's date, March 31, 2026. First article is from Sunday, March 1, 2026. Terrible Muses, a new biography explores the forces that formed the young Alfred Tennyson by Katherine Nicholson. My dear Fitz, ain't I a beast for not answering you before? Not that I am going to write to you now, the 1847 letter begins. My book is out, and I hate it, and so no doubt will you. It's signed A. Tennyson. Fitz was Edward Fitzgerald. His correspondent was his hapless friend Alfred. Both men were nearing 40. Fitzgerald had family money, but Alfred was a vagrant social misfit, prone to depression, awkward with women, addicted to his malodorous pipe, and seemingly bent on squandering every particle of his abundant natural talent. Two earlier collections of verse had been largely well received by critics, but mostly Alfred wrote poems he didn't publish, preferring to revise them obsessively and recite them unrequested and at great length at parties. Now, at long last, one of them had appeared in print. The Princess, a medley, is a blank verse romance in 7 books on the theme of higher education for women. Its tone varying, in the author's words, from mock heroic gigantesque to true sublime. Reviewers were baffled. Eminently, he is worthy to be the poet of our time, wrote one. Why does he not assume his mission? It was, as Richard Holmes's absorbing new biography makes clear, what everyone wanted to know. The Boundless Deep is partly a retelling of the emotional cataclysm of the death of author Hallam, Tennyson's beloved friend at 22. But it is also the story of how what Tennyson called the terrible muses of astronomy and geology alchemized this personal grief into a profound reckoning. Eventually, these twin crises of faith, theological and metaphysical, produced a poem, In Memoriam A.H.H., that secured Tennyson's place at the pinnacle of Victorian culture, where he remains in popular memory as a titled lavishly bearded eminence. But for anxious, aimless years at a time, Holmes demonstrates he seemed doomed to loneliness, doubt, and willful eccentricity. He was born in 1809. When Tennyson went up to Cambridge in 1828, Charles Darwin was there too, a lackluster classic student with a burgeoning interest in botany and entomology. Nearly everyone had some interest in natural science. It was the apex of what Holmes considers the Age of Wonder, as he titled a prize-winning earlier book of stargazing, ballooning, and ocean adventuring. Tennyson's tutor was at work on study of astronomy, in which he speculated about the possibility of life on other planets. But the real revolution was underfoot in the field of geology. Excavations across England had exposed the bones of an extinct race of giant lizards. Earth's own past, it appeared, was as vast and uncharted as outer space, and as subject to catastrophic upheaval. Tennyson eagerly debated the implications of such discoveries. His childhood had primed him for skepticism. His father was a clergyman, a disinherited elder son without a vocation. He tutored his 11 children in Latin and Greek, poetry, philosophy, botany, and physics, and was, Holmes reports, a good scholar when sober and not in a rage. His 4 daughters grew up bookish and odd. His 7 sons were scarred by his brutality, their brilliance warped by addiction and mental instability. Cambridge provided a mooring for young Alfred, as did his growing intimacy with the wealthy, golden-haired Hallam. The two shared a fondness for Shelley and metaphysics. Tennyson brought Hallam home to meet his family, who were equally smitten. In August, the two young men embarked on a hike through the French Pyrenees, serving briefly as smugglers for Spanish revolutionaries. Alfred Tennyson returned home with a newly dramatic style of dress, a long black Spanish cloak and a wide-brimmed hat, and a discomfiting realization. Hallam was in love with Tennyson's younger sister, Emily. Hallam's father harbored doubts about his connection to the Tennysons. Eager to wrest control of his son's future, he took him abroad. In Vienna, on September 15, 1833, Arthur Hallam died of a stroke. The news reached Alfred and Emily in October, while Arthur's body was still making its way home to England by steamer. In a long butcher ledger-like book, Alfred began to write a series of poems, elegies for his lost friend that were also elegies for a universe in which human life had transcendent meaning and value. Over the next 17 years, the butcher book grew to contain more than 100 poems, which Tennyson finally published in May 1850. 2 weeks later, he suddenly married a longtime friend, Emily Selwood. By year's end, In Memoriam had sold an astonishing 60,000 copies. Critics were rapturous. Queen Victoria appointed Tennyson poet laureate. It was an extraordinary ascent, an apotheosis almost. Only Fitzgerald, Tennyson's old friend, seemed anything but delighted, fearful that long malice followed by sudden celebrity had spoiled him for the great work he ought now to be entering on. Fitzgerald wasn't wrong to worry. In the decades to come, Tennyson would write some extraordinary poems, but he also wrote a great deal of mediocre verse on gigastic themes, famously The Charge of the Light Brigade, less famously a brief lyric urging the formation of local militias titled Rifle Clubs. Most of his energy went to enacting his public role as national sage and adding to the tedious bulk of Idylls of the King, a Neil-Arthurian cycle of narrative verse. Holmes' emphatic rendering of the sadness and isolation of the first half of Tennyson's life makes it hard to begrudge him the cushioned respectability of the second. But it also invites us to appreciate the remarkable fruits of his protracted estrangement. At the center of In Memoriam is the vision of nature red in tooth and claw, whose savage genius makes and unmakes individual and species alike. Most Victorian readers seem to have taken at face value the poem's calculatedly orthodox prologue, a last-minute addition in which Tennyson insists that faith has finally triumphed over doubt. But reading the poem 80 years later, T.S. Eliot saw past the pious platitudes to an enduring and essentially modern hymn of unknowing. In Memoriam is not religious because of the quality of its faith, but because of the quality of its doubt, he wrote in 1932. Its faith is a poor thing, but its doubt is a very intense experience. The next article is from the Sunday, March 8, 2026 issue. Unfortunate Sons. A journalist offers a rare, illuminating look at the way the Vietnam War shaped the struggle for equality back home, by Brent Staples. The New York Times war correspondent, David Halberstam, caught the pulse of his era when he observed in 1964 that there were parallels between America's misbegotten adventure in Vietnam and the struggle for civil rights in the murderous Klan-infested state of Mississippi. The similarities were obvious to black people who were battling Jim Crow as their sons were shipped off to war by all-white draft boards placed under the command of a heavily Southern, lily-white officer corps and often assigned to missions that would send them home in flag-draped coffins. In the first years of the war, It was more than coincidental that the frontline fighters wore disproportionately black. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara and the other federal officials whom Haberstam derisively called the best and the brightest had contrived to capture thousands of souls for the ill-fated war on communism by lowering testing standards and allowing the courts to drop criminal charges against young men who agreed to enlist. The scheme known as Project 100,000 protected the white middle class by preserving college deferments. Nearly half of those brought in by the project were black, though African Americans made up little more than 10% of the population, and nearly all were poor. The journalist Will Haygood leverages this scenario to excellent effect in his clarifying and richly insightful Vietnam-era history, The War Within a War. As Haygood notes, Project 100,000 was cynically billed as part of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. But behind closed doors, the famously salty president slipped into his neo-Confederate drawl, praising the project as a means of cleaning up all these Negro boys that are now rejects. Vietnam represented a departure from earlier conflicts in which the country was reluctant to let black people fight and die for the nation that had been built upon their backs. Still, the Pentagon was willing to tolerate black soldiers only in as much as they forswore cultural expressions of blackness. They could be arrested and even court-martialed for performing a ritual greeting known as the DAP, short for dignity and pride, which ranged from a simple fist bump and handshake to an elaborate display of grips, finger snaps, and chest thumps that often varied from squad to squad, platoon to platoon. The gesture that the military viewed as sinister and disruptive was, for black servicemen, an oath to solidarity and mutual protection. By criminalizing the DAP, the Pentagon hardened it into a signifier of resistance that crossed the ocean from Vietnam to the riot-torn streets of the United States just in time to become a signature salutation of the Black Power movement. Haygood describes the black veterans who returned home with mental health problems, heroin addictions, or garden variety Vietnam blues as the oral historians of America's first truly integrated war. There are soliloquies from front porches, beneath corner lamplights, in barbershops, in basements, became a powerful recurring theme in urban life. The storytelling went the other way, too. Black Americans who arrived in Vietnam from the United States brought along news of burning cities and pitched battles between black residents and National Guardsmen. Civil rights histories typically treat Vietnam as an external matter that came to the fore domestically when the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. condemned it on moral grounds in 1967. But the War Within a War conceives of Vietnam as a foreign theater of the rights struggle, in which concerns about inequality were magnified by the fact that black soldiers were being asked to die for a country that discriminated against them in housing, employment, and education. The view of the war as racially unfair spread swiftly through almost every aspect of African-American life. By 1967, Haywood points out, black Mississippians had started linking their battles for voting rights to the unfair burden borne by their sons in Vietnam. That same year, the global celebrity Muhammad Ali surrendered the heavyweight boxing title rather than serve, declaring the war a racist act of aggression against the brown people of Southeast Asia. The Motown singer Marvin Gaye responded to the Vietnam nightmare witnessed by his veteran brother Frankie with the epic 1971 album What's Going On. As Haygood writes, the album's moving portrayal of a soldier returning home landed like slow and rolling thunder, ushering politicians, activists, and bereaved mothers into the Church of Marvin. Haygood's earlier books, including biographies of Sammy Davis Jr. and Adam Clayton Powell Jr., earned him a reputation as a temperate and perceptive social historian. He maintains his characteristic low-key tone as he explains why the full picture of Black Vietnam went unseen by most Americans. The white press corps was uninterested in questions of how race and racism were shaping the blackest war in our national history. White news organizations began to integrate out of necessity during the riots of the late 60s, which were typically sparked by police violence. But it was some time before black journalists won prestigious foreign assignments or gained a clout to shape stories that passed through layers of white editors on the way into print. Haygood alludes to these problems as he retells the war through the lives of 9 African Americans, most of them soldiers. Among his subjects are Joe Anderson, the infantry commander, whose exploits in battle were captured by an Academy Award-winning documentary, Philippa Schuler, the fascinatingly eccentric concert pianist who died in a helicopter crash while rescuing Vietnamese orphans, many of whom had been fathered by black troops, and Wallace Terry, a reporter for Time, who struggled to convey what he had found in the war into the pages of the magazine. Complaints about racial discrimination reached a crescendo just as the Pentagon was congratulating itself for integrating the fighting force. In 1968, an African-American major named Lavelle Merritt made an unexpected appearance at a daily press briefing. He used the occasion to denounce the American military services as the strongest citadels of racism on the face of the earth, and proclaimed that black officers like him were Uncle Toms, who had been glorifying in our pseudo-acceptance by our fellow officers and clinging to the mistaken belief that patience, diligence, and professional competence would yield the benefits enjoyed by the majority ethnic groups. He further startled listeners by declaring that only by being a good nigger had he been able to get a satisfactory rating from a racist superior. Merritt's words resounded through the military and around the civilian world. After 18 years in the Army, he was forced into retirement. Just before he left the armed forces, he wrote a letter to President Johnson. "I understand the magnitude of the bitterness and animosity that would be heaped upon me," he said. But he was surprised by the fear that prevented the military from acknowledging its race problem and moving toward just treatment for all who served. The next article comes from the Sunday, March 15, 2026 issue. A Nation Erased. Alvaro Enriquez's new novel weaves past and present in a Baroque anti-Western set in contested borderlands. By Dwight Gardner. "Men are so sweet when they do manly things," a woman comments in Alvaro Enriquez's new novel, Now I Surrender, a Baroque and semi-comic anti-Western set primarily along the U.S.-Mexican border in the 19th century. Its subject is the Apache Wars and, by extension, the Apache extermination. It's about the ghost nation left behind. How Baroque? The woman who delivers the Men Are So Sweet analysis is a former Zarzula singer named Elvis, birth name Elvira, who wears a nun's habit and swashbuckling capes. She arrives draped in cartridge belts and has an enormous Colt revolver dangling at her hip. Badges? She does not require any stinking badges. Elvis quotes Shakespeare, shoots coins out of the sky, and makes declarations such as, "Yeehaw! Cabroons, you're entering the vagina of the Sonora," as her posse rides into sultry ravines. If you see her coming, it's worse word, ho, to borrow from Samuel Beckett. Up on a horse, her stony gaze tends to veer between arrogant and interplanetary. We're in Enrique territory, all right. This gifted Mexican writer, born in 1969, delivers novels that are steeped in history and have a hallucinatory sense of pageantry. Reading him, you sense you are watching the passing of a long, antic, blood-flecked cortege or a trans-hemispheric second-line parade, one threaded with the vestiges of old mythologies. His last novel, You Dreamed of Empires, was a satirical reimagining of the 1519 meeting between Hernan Cortes, the Spanish conquistador, and Montezuma, emperor of the Aztecs, in what is now Mexico City. It was deservedly one of this publication's top 10 books of 2024. This new work takes its title from the words that Geronimo, the Apache medicine man and military leader, spoke upon his former surrender to the United States Army in 1886. About a third of Enrique's novel deals with the machinations surrounding Geronimo's capitulation, as well as his final decades as an unlikely celebrity. He appeared at a World's Fair and at Theodore Roosevelt's 1905 inauguration, gawked at by tens of thousands, before dying at Fort Sill in Oklahoma. Another third of the book is about a woman who is kidnapped after an Apache raid in 1836, and about the Mexican lieutenant colonel who, while searching for cattle rustlers, tries to track her down as well. Elvis is part of his party. This thread has resonances with the story of Cynthia Ann Parker, an American who was taken at 9 by a Comanche band and later married and had children with a chief. In her 30s, she was separated against her will from her Comanche family. The final third is about a present-day writer with striking similarities to Enrique, who takes his family on a road trip. For him, it's research excursion, though Apacheria, the sun-seared expanse of the Southwest, where the historical sections take place. Now I Surrender has been convincingly rendered into English by Natasha Wimmer, the translator of Roberto Bolaño's best novels, and you can sense a bit of Bolaño in Enrique, the postmodern playfulness, the cosmopolitanism, the historical conscience. Enrique's new one has a bit of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, that brutal epic also set along the U.S.-Mexico border in it as well. Yet despite the frequent intensities here, the three narratives in Now I Surrender never quite cohere. By the end, with the Geronimo material, you sense that Enrique is filibustering, leaning too heavily on his research, as he introduces character after character and explores every wrinkle of the negotiations over Geronimo's fate. He pays such extreme deference to his female characters, with one over-the-top exception, that they are not allowed to be quite human. This is a long book, 456 pages, that feels even longer. He leaves the metafictional scaffolding up, sometimes winningly declaring early on. The idea is to write a book about a country that still exists but was erased from the maps, a country that worked just as well or badly as any other country and that was taken away from us like cassette tapes or incandescent light bulbs, where Sonora, Chihuahua, Arizona, and New Mexico meet today was at Atlantis, an in-between country, and straddling it were the Mexicans and the gringos, like two children, eyes shut, their backs to each other, while the Apache scuttled back and forth between their legs, not sure where to go with strangers bubbling up everywhere, filling their lands. The author character, like Enrique, lives mostly in Harlem, but he has green card issues and feels caught between loyalties and between worlds. He travels in a station wagon with his second wife and their two children, as well as an older son from his first marriage, from whom he feels estranged. I'd be first in line to read an entire memoir from this excellent writer. But some of this first-person material blends uneasily with the intense kidnapping and almost Sadian torture scenes that dot this novel. Learning that the family has Paul Simon's Graceland on the car stereo as they enter the Mississippi Delta, that the author's wife rolls her eyes at his devotion to baseball and opera, or that they all have an Asian fusion meal in New Mexico detracts from the spell Enrique is working to cast. Enrique has always been a fox in a hedgehog mask. I mean this as a compliment, but his genre blending, in this case, is less seamless than it has been in the past. Here's one reason I love reading Enrique anyway. The tough guys in his fiction often have effeminate sides. Some of their boots have improbable heels, and they're always taking miniature pratfalls. They sniff and wipe their earwax on their trousers. They have bits of scrambled eggs stuck in their mustachios. If Enrique were remaking High Noon, Gary Cooper would have public lice. This author has a natural appetite for subversion. Enrique's novels are not the places to come if you are nostalgic for notional simplicities of the American past. He's one of the best we have, and he's not done pushing against conventions. We all keep scribbling like fools in the notebook of faith, he writes, as if anything will ever change. The next article is from the March 22, 2026 issue. Group chat. Five women reckon with the joys, struggles, and shifting priorities of adulthood. By Joanna Katib. In 1963, the New York Review of Books published a scathing parody of Mary McCarthy's blockbuster novel of female friendship, The Group, under the byline Xavier Prin. The gang is a brief set piece centered on a young woman's defloration and perfectly lampoons McCarthy's style. It even parrots the conspicuously Scandinavian spelling of a paramour's name that becomes a quirk of the novel. The sketch isn't outrightly cruel, but it's impossible to read without detecting an undertow of jealousy and affection. In other words, the competing feelings we reserve for our dearest friends. Prin turned out to be the critic Elizabeth Hardwick. Naturally, she and McCarthy were close. The five friends in Clutch, Emily Neiman's new novel, would recognize that cocktail of love and resentment, even if none have the gall or traitorous instincts to act on it. The story follows the women over an exceptionally busy period, 3 months bursting with a funeral, a concealed pregnancy, marital implosions, and corgi trauma. And that's just a start. Now, all 40 or close to it, Reba, Bella, Carson, Greg, and Hillary have been friends since college, but rarely see one another. Their group chat is alive, though, which is where Bella, a Manhattan lawyer whose brain mulches anxiety and dissatisfaction into miserable confetti, declares that something must be done. Reba, a former corporate efficiency expert, a.k.a. ruthless shrinker of workforces, now unemployed by choice and trying to get pregnant, suggests they converge in Palm Springs one mid-January weekend. Clever, because no one on earth has plans that soon into the year, and fortunate for us. A desert getaway featuring psychedelic chocolates, or a dessert getaway featuring psychedelic chocolates and poolside grousing, is an ideal setting to meet the women and stress test their dynamics. Hillary, a physician hiding the depth of her estranged husband's addiction issues, arrives from Chicago, fearing her young son's inevitable meltdowns. Carson, a writer living in Brooklyn, with roommates, no less, was once described by a reviewer as Mary McCarthy, but coked out. She's been vague about her long gestating second novel and the family secret it stirred. As the only unmarried friend with the wobbliest finances, she can feel out of step with the others, and when cornered, bickers like a younger, know-it-all sister. Greg, a progressive Texas legislator with national ambitions married to a Muscus Tech gazillionaire, arrives late in Palm Springs after flying private. Shots of her breastfeeding in the state capitol have transformed her into a firebrand feminist, though at home she's wrestling her husband's maniacal ego and losing. She inspires, at least in Bella, a flood of comparisons and envy. Greg makes aging seem so easy and looks great in a jumpsuit. Thank God none of the women have it all. Niemans is meticulous in building each character's universe, stacking them with blessings and obstacles alike. In Hillary's, she draws an acutely sensitive portrayal of addiction. The willful blindness involved in loving an addict, the aspiration, it's all there, and it's devastating. Once Hillary became a mother, her loyalty shifted from her spouse to their son. This was whom she was meant to protect, not some grown-ass man whose medical specialty was ortho disappointing her, she thinks, and stops lancing the abscesses at her husband's injection sites. Neiman's absurd, mordant outlook keeps the story from resembling a soap opera, as does her pitch-black sense of humor. At a house party full of caviar, one of the women, while immersed in a motherhood quandary, asks another if there's something psychotic and untoward in her devouring piles of tiny eggs. The sixth silent member of their group is time itself. Neiman's animates it like a breathing being, one we see sprinting and creeping and speed-walking along. Time has thwarted each of the women in banal and profound ways, from election and fertility cycles to traffic jams and the interminable wait for a life-changing letter. McCarthy once described the group as a history of the loss of faith in progress for women, and a pessimistic reader could say the same of Clutch. Each character has been leveled by life in some way, resembling the Wayne Thiebaud model on the book's cover, flattened by misogamy or malignant passive aggression of betrayal. But I rooted for these women, love them, and cherish the omniscient aside sprinkled throughout hinting at happy endings, even far beyond the novel. A man Carson will soon encounter was the last future boyfriend, but nobody knew that yet. What I wouldn't give to know that my friends and I will end up okay, to have someone with Neiman's feral intelligence mapping our paths. We'll have to make do with AI astrology instead. Midway through Clutch, in the waiting room of a health clinic, we see a small girl who is trying to assemble a complicated puzzle. There's time again, the child, an innocent miniature of the women solving more existential problems in the office. After her procedure, one of the friends asks what she's missed. Everything and nothing. The clock hands kept spinning around the dial. The next article comes from the Sunday, March 29, 2026 issue. Follow the River, a novel of interconnected narratives about climate change and the rise of authoritarianism by Siddhartha Deb. At the beginning of Saraswati, Gurneik Johal's clamorous, inventive, and polyphonic novel, the mythical river of the title bubbles to life on a sleepy agricultural plot in India. To the Hindu rite dispensation ruling the country, this is a sign of rebirth, the revitalization of a glorious past rather than the troubling outcome of melting glaciers in the Himalayas. India might be trapped in a polycrisis of inequality, authoritarianism, and climate change, but the return of the Saraswati, a sacred symbol of Vedic legend, will allow the nation to harness ancient glory in a techno-futuristic present. It's not just the country's history arriving at your doorstep, it's the country's future, a leader of the Hindu rite says to his admiring audience. This is a complex backdrop one that sounds quite plausible to those with even a cursory knowledge of India in recent decades. Johal brings to this context an inquiring mind, one that ambitiously shifts through the demented, fantastical nature of right-wing politics in India while connecting it to systemic planetary collapse. Seven novellas told through the perspective of characters descended from the same ancestors in the North Indian state of Punjab serve as the book's interweaving narrative lines. Scattered through the world as part of a global Shkik diaspora, these characters allow Johal to offer glimpses of an earth in crisis, while the story of the river's return and the rise of the Hindu right forms a through line that connects them all. Reminiscent, on the one hand, of global novels like David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, and on the other, of a more politically edgy South Asian fiction such as Numar Atif Chowdhury's Babu Bangladesh and Subhanji Swarup's Latitudes of Longing, Johal's book explores a wide range of ideas and locations. Beginning with Satnam, a London-based corporate drone who has inherited the land where the Saraswati emerges, and branching out to protagonists in Kenya, Singapore, and Canada, the principal characters seem to embody the seven legendary rivers of Punjab. They mirror other motives, too. A piece of pulkari cloth woven by one of the ancestors and sliced into seven pieces, and the regional kizas, or oral tales, inserted between the seven stories. The book is a rich tapestry, occasionally bewildering, often beguiling. In just one narrative centered on Guan, a former musician turned eco-activist in British Columbia, we learn about the spruce beetle, the Hindustani raga Meg Malhar, how to spike trees to disrupt commercial logging, and the history of the anti-colonial Gadar movement in the United States in the 1920s. Gihan is possibly the most compelling of the protagonists, the most in sync with the novel's anguish. Trapped in her apartment by a furious storm, and reflecting in a long hypnotic paragraph on the state of the world, she seems to become almost a voice for the planet. Fires in Saskatchewan, in Manitoba, in Australia, in the Amazon. Fires in Europe, in the Middle East. There were fires all across Asia. Polling stations were burning, supermarkets. There were yachts on fire. Fires spreading through cruise ships. Protesters dancing in front of the White House, people gluing themselves to the gates of Parliament. The novel, Johal's First, is strongest in these sections of diasporic foraging, offering its most affecting characters, Huyuan Harsimran, a stunt double in Singapore, and Natu, an archaeologist in Kenya. It is less assured when focusing on India and how its Hindu right government manipulates media, mass hysteria, and technology to promote its authoritarian regime. Johal's fictional demagogues, General Prakash Jai and the Prime Minister Narayan Indra, aren't particularly convincing, and neither are their foot soldiers. Similarly, the texture of light in this quasi dystopic India feels thin, rendered theoretically rather than through deep engagement with lived experience. Johal checks off some aspects of the Hindus' rites modus operandi, its mob lynchings and bulldozing of shrines and slums. And yet the novel never quite comes to terms with the everyday horror of Muslim lives in India or the ghastly self-distortions practiced by upper caste Hindus. It doesn't help either that the two characters tasked most heavily with the India sections of the story are Satnam and an unnamed and rather implausible Indian journalist who narrates many of the events around the rebirth of the river and connects the other protagonists. Nevertheless, the novel convinces far more often than not, grappling with the complex ideas, brave in its effort to parse inequality, and principled in its attempts to connect the strands of colonialism, authoritarianism, and climate collapse. Saraswati is a welcome shift from the family dramas and autofictions that have tended to dominate literary renderings of India. In fact, as Johal shows us, while the Hindu rite continues its rhetoric casting, India has the first, oldest, and grandest civilization in the world. It is very much in line with the dark state of the planet, offering tawdry, fascist delusions in the face of melting glaciers, rising oceans, and receding groundwater. This article is from the Sunday, March 15, 2026 edition. Beloved, a thrilling new study by a novelist and scholar subjects the Nobel laureate Toni Morrison's work to rigorous inspection by Wesley Morris. The stratosphere is a kind of in-between space for an artist. Maybe you've achieved the celestial, but then all you got is everybody gazing up at you, existing under you, loving the idea of you, the light of you, the gas of you, your myth. The question becomes, who's touching you? Often not much criticism, not rigorous criticism. I get it. The stratosphere is all the way up there. Upon arrival, who would know they were even there? It's perilous. The air? Wait, what air? Toni Morrison is stratospheric. The legend of her seems to speak for itself. The novels, the Nobel, the lectures, the former students, the decades of university syllabuses, although still not enough. The famous inner and still more inner circle, the known unknown of her, the unknown known, the many of her raised eyebrows, literally sucked teeth, and that radiological intellectual gaze. Who's touching any of that? Well, who's deploying criticism to touch it? Some of us have been waiting for an astronaut to suit up and head out there. For not even a debunking, let alone a dethroning, but just a great big reminder that this woman is no less in sore selling when experienced right here on Earth under the guidance of a writer with a magnifying glass, a scalpel, and maybe an ashtray. Evidently, Namwali Sirpal, the novelist, and in the pages of The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books, an absorbingly surgical critic, has been one of us waiting people. The difference is that she's done what we haven't, hopped on a rocket and touched the tonosphere with her mind. This is an aptly Toni Morrison thing to do. Write the book you've been dying to read. What Sirpal's written, devised, built is On Morrison, a novel by novel trustees on inspection of, spelunking into, playing with Morrisonian philosophy, aesthetics, craft, and she might be having the time of her life. Morrison, I think, does this to people who care enough to burrow into the text, exhilarate their intellect. Everybody finds something different. The critic and scholar Daphne Brooks, for instance, offers ways of experiencing the musicality, particularly the blues, that imbues the novels, that the novels exude. Each chapter in On Morrison feeds the novels through a single grand idea or two. Comedy in Song of Solomon, the function of names in Sula, and numbers in Paradise. A happy familiarity or deep fluency with these books leaves you open to the anticipation of somebody else's facility with them. I liken it to reading a superbly revealing profile of some person of note whom you know better because an astute writer located the truth of them. This book, in that sense, is a revelation. Sirpal teaches literature herself, and On Morrison opens with what feels like a salvo for one of her courses. Part of my project in this book, she writes, is to show you how to read Morrison with the seriousness that she deserves. The way Serpell aims to frame that seriousness is through the knot or bind of gender and race, a knot that also binds Serpell to Morrison. And yet never so tightly that she feels strapped to her, she indulges a more earnest flavor of her subject's swag. Over the years, through my work and experience as a literature professor and fiction writer of the novels, The Old Drift, and The Furrows, I've learned a lot about the Black cultural traditions that ground her aesthetics. And I am, as she often said of herself, a very good reader. I got to the end of that sentence and thought, okay, then let's go. Serpell can boast like that, saying she's more than up to the task. Because she's more than up to the task. One word that's likely to appear even a dismissal of this book, and I don't see anyone seriously dismissing it, is some version of rigor. Serpell has done the work, and you can feel her working still, on almost every page. Her mind is alive. Yes, this is a rigor born from, or at least assisted by, what Serpell calls the archive, that cosmic storage locker that also tends to be physically housed within a library. Morrison lives at Princeton. It's the rigor of a mind plumbing. There are moments in the assessments of each book, up through Paradise, novel number 7, and on almost every page of the chapter devoted to jazz, where I could hear a sizzle. She's putting these books on the grill. The rigor summoned in a search for what makes Morrison such a titanic figure. But Serpell knows that one strategy for achieving this is first at the sentence level and then as a case for structure. Words are unpacked. Literary terms, genres, and philosophical ideas are launched. Contrablazon, paralepsis, chiaroscuro, polytopton, antiphrasis, ipsiety, antanaclasis, free indirect style, zeugma, ekphrasis, recitative, antiphony, mondegry, chronotopes, anagnorisis, intertextuality, and metafiction, chiamus, rhizome, iodialect, the mathematical and dynamical sublimes. Syncretism is everywhere. There is an entire section on structuralism as conceived by Ferdinand de Saussure. When you lay it out like that, all of those ideas, I have the same thought I do when I look at the instruments on my dental hygienist tray. Ain't no way she used all those on me. She did. Serpell does. Her character on Song of Solomon and a long passage on Playing in the Dark from 1992, Morris's binocular peering into Blackness's function in the U.S. literary canon, spent time rooting through the guts of old Black comic and performative and critical forms like Signifying, Playing in the Dozens, Reading, and Shade. Serpell performs many disquisitions on anthropological syncretism, which in her analysis struck me anew as the novelist's equivalent of a sampler's record crate. She uses the occasion of The Bluest Eye, a book imagining the psychological blast radius of incest and rape, to wonder about an assortment of cultural maladies, censorship, identity, politics run amok. Why, she wants to know, would prominent thinkers and authors gather to read this novel aloud in public? Why would you teach it in junior high? This is to say that Serpell's excitement, her sense of discovery and dismay, become yours. Her ingenious connections of Morrison to Nabokov, to Allison, to Disney, to the ancient Greeks inspire you to do your own connecting. Her beloved chapter includes a passage on the multiple judgments among the characters of Seth's murder. Some would say her sparring of her infant daughter and surmises that the reader is left without a clear position on whose judgment is right. Then she imposes the concept of value in commensurability and the thinking of the critic William Epson, the author of Seven Types of Ambiguity. And suddenly, all I could think about was O.J. and the trial and the polarized reactions to both. You learn to trust that the book's chowdery bits will somehow bear fruit. Take her chapter on Morrison's short story, Recitative, about two friends, a black woman and a white woman, whose respective races Morrison withholds. Serpell takes us through a heavy lecture on post-structuralist concepts like language deriving meaning from negative comparison, meaning that meaning springs more from what something isn't like than from what it is like. Ah, the stultifying stuff of intermediate lit theory. But then she applies her lesson to the text, and I heard a click. My hand actually shut up like I was 15. A connection, one based on something as simple but loaded as an M-dash that, in Morrison's story, separates black from white, holding one separate from the other, conjoining one to the other, handcuffing it. A separator that prevents or forbids one word from becoming the other. In the case of the short story, one doesn't make sense without the other, loses its meaning. The race is then something new, black, white. I couldn't have had a thought like that without the inspiration of Serpell's rigor to notice it. Who knows what kind of grade that would get me in her class, but I was thinking about a familiar text in a new way. That's the excitement of this book. An author whose mind I had already admired, whose thinking I love being confounded by, love stenciling with, love getting lost in, love reciting, love trying to understand, love reading other people's attempts to understand, is being explored book by someone with the intellectual stamina and sense of rhyme to move with Morrison. Serpell can dance. The critical enterprise of On Morrison corresponds with a quickening moral imperative to keep Morrison on our lips, to keep her lofty, stratospheric. The book grasps the forces that seek to reduce, overlook, discard these books, and not on the merits. The forces are old. I have a strong, pungent memory of watching Harold Bloom on Charlie Rose's old show in what, 1994? Holding forth about his Western canon project and inveighing, at some point, against Maya Angelou, Alice Walker, and Morrison, disparaging the artistic merit of their work. These were political writers. Bloom seemed most alarmed at what had, in his estimation, befallen Morrison. She began as a very strong writer and reached a kind of culmination in Song of Solomon, he informed Rose. Unfortunately, her sense of what she would call her responsibility to, she now calls herself, as you know, a Marxist, a feminist, an Afrocentrist, and all of these things. Beloved and Jazz, even more than Beloved, are, I think, top-heavy books with very strong political programs. They're not aesthetic accomplishments, he went on. She has been, I believe, victimized by the times in trying to give the age what she feels the age demands. What made Song of Solomon worthy to Bloom came down to his identification in it of a Western tradition. He could detect in her writing some Wolfe, some Faulkner, and when he lost their trace in Beloved, the book lost him, because it ceased to obediently correspond with the traditional Western literary frameworks as erected by him. I have tried to read Beloved the way you would a regular masterpiece, but Morrison won't let me. As Serpell argues, something new was going on in Beloved, in its structure, its metaphysics, its intimidating instability. Morrison exposed Bloom's canon blindness, inducing him to smash up and throw out what he hadn't been trained to know how to read. I think Morrison came to confound him, and politics was a convenient garbage chute to drop Beloved down. And yet, he at least took the novel seriously. I also discovered my favorite poet from that Charlie Rose conversation, Thelious Moss, Stanley Crouch, in a famously dyspeptic and fairly typical heave-ho from 1987 declaimed Beloved, a blackface Holocaust novel. He wrote more than that, but none of what he wrote lives up, or rather down, to that triptych. Morrison seemed to handle the pans fine. It so happens that Knopf has just published, with notes and an introduction by the literary scholar and Princeton professor Claudia Brodsky, a new collection of Morrison's lectures on the great books, Language as Liberation, Reflections on the American Canon. Nonetheless, that sort of criticism leads us to ship our geniuses, especially our black woman geniuses, off to the upper reaches to make them untouchable, to keep them out of arm's way reach. This isn't to say that Morrison's work couldn't withstand the analytic force Sapel applies here to dismantle and unpack, as it were. Her work is richer for the vastness and intimacy of Sapel's reading. The question is, how far down would a negative application of that kind of force even reach? Telling that toward the end of the book, it's Sapel who sharpens her knives, not for one of the novels, but for all the things. Morrison's poems, none of which I've read until now, they've got the down and dirty stank you can find all over her fiction. Here, the erudition that had been making Sapel's book such a thrill wilts into a complaint about the offensive mediocrity of Morrison's verse. Sapel cuts because she cares, because she's curious. Does this woman bleed? But it also feels as if she cuts because she must. See the author of O. Morrison get really on Morrison? May she never again come this close to squatting near Stanley's Crouch. It is possible that Morrison had been overrated and overvalued, so that the meaning of the work, its complexity, its surprises, its daring, its impossibility, winds up overshadowed by the imposition of oracularity. Save us, Tony. Tell him, Tony. Show me, Tony. Out of novels to operate on, Sapel spends her latter pages thinking through her wariness of Morrison's monumentalization. Her book leaves you high because Morrison has passed this one particular critic and novelist's inspection, saying Tony holds up. This is not a book of crosswords or intellectual counterargument. Let someone else write the book with all that heart. I dare them. But be the unorthodoxy you hope to see. Sapel climbed an intellectual, scholastic, academic mountain and discovered what I imagine she already knew before reporting for duty. Morrison is up there for good reason. At this point, we'll end, and I want to wish all a happy, healthy Easter. And that's American Easter, because I myself am Orthodox, so our Easter's the week after. So for everyone who will be celebrating Easter now or a week later, God bless you all. Bye now.